Let's pray. Lord, for those who are here, for those who will be watching this later, I pray that you would help us. I pray that you would open our hearts and our minds to your word. Open our mouths to speak what you would have us speak. Give us the wisdom that we need, Lord. And let us humbly receive from your word what you have told us. Be with us tonight for the sake of your name and the sake of your glory, I pray. In the marriages represented here and those that are yet to come, and for the marriages of those that we care about and will counsel in our lives, and for everything Lord, that only you know, would you help us tonight? For Jesus' sake, amen. All right. One of my favorite pictures in the church, and I don't have it on, or one of my favorite pictures of this church, I'm going to show you here in a moment, and I'm going to do it really low tech, lo-fi. I'm just going to turn around my iPad and show it to you. I don't have it up on the screen, but this is one of my favorite sites in this whole building. And I'm going to show it to you guys and see if you can, A, tell me where this is, and then why this would be one of my favorite sites in the church. Okay, so where is that, first of all? Okay, so that's the door going out right above the lock, and the paint is just beat to pieces, just scratched. Why do I love that so much? Okay, but particularly, why is the paint so scratched? I'll give you a hint. Human skin did not do that. Flesh and blood did not cause those scratches. Where do all those scratches come from? Wedding rings. Those are hands on the door. My prevailing theory, at least. And that's wedding rings wearing down that surface over time. And I've looked at that and thought, we should paint that. Well, there's a few things we should paint around here. But more importantly, to me, it is just a beautiful little visual reminder of the faithful marriages and just the marriages in general, which we worked hard to make to help them be faithful, that the marriages represented in our church, and the way in which we are affected by marriage, but also marriage affects us. It affects our environment. There's a whole parable there. And it's just a picture of the effects of faithfulness. And in more ways than one, the marriages of this church, of this Christian community in Nipawin, they affect us as a church, not just our building, not just the paint. They really affect us. It's just a good reminder of one of the reasons why we're doing this. Marriage is important. Let's review what we discussed last time, because today is really part two of last month. So we're talking about husbands and wives and what it means to be married as a man and as a woman, not just as a spouse. And last time we saw God's design for men and women. And I shared this last time, but it's worth repeating. As time goes on, I think the idea of the roles of men and women is language that I'm growing uncomfortable with, because roles can be played or not played. Roles can be picked up and set down. You can swap roles. And if we talk about the roles of men and women, it lends to this view that God needed someone to do a job and pick someone for the job. But if we talk about God's design for men and women, now we're talking about something that's more built into who we are. And we saw Genesis 1 and 2, some big differences between Adam and Eve. Their similarity is emphasized, right? Adam can't find anyone suitable for him among the animals. He sees Eve and says, at last, right? He recognizes her, bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. So there's a great similarity between men and women. And that in many ways we could delineate all the similarities between us. We We're both humans. We both are created in God's image. We are both equal in our dignity, in our worth, in our value, in the different ways that we can serve God to fulfill the mission He's given us. It is still the same mission. So there's lots of ways in which we're similar, but we see some big differences in Genesis 1 and 2. Adam was created outside of the garden. Eve was created inside of the garden. By the way, when I do that, that's kind of like help me out here. Finish my sentences for me. Adam was created from the dirt. Eve was created from Adam. Adam was created for a job without anyone else around. Eve was created to help Adam with that job. And those are some of the differences that we see in Genesis 1 and 2, long before we get to the fall, long before we get to the curse. We saw last time how this design that's kind of baked into us from the beginning really impacts us. We saw how men can tend to be very task-oriented, work-oriented, lose themselves in their jobs, which is not good. It just helps us understand some of where this comes from. Men tend to be oriented to seek significance. This is why men crave respect, which again can be taken in a very sinful, idolatrous way, where it's something that's demanded and temper tantrums are thrown if it's not given. But nevertheless, we can see where just the masculine soul is shaped in certain directions. Men crave significance. This is one of the reasons why video games and online substitutes for intimacy, thinking of pornography, but there's other things as well that we could online substitutes, not just for intimacy, but let me finish my sentence before I keep adding things to the list. This is one of the reasons why something like video games or pornography can be so dangerous, because it gives a man an artificial sense of significance. It gives him the feeling like he's accomplished something great, which is something that's kind of baked into a man's soul, that he wants to accomplish something great. And you can feel like you've accomplished something great when you haven't. Pornography gives you the feeling that you've won the heart of a woman when you actually have done nothing of the sort. And that's why it's so highly dangerous. And not to say, particularly with video games, not to say there can't be an appropriate use of them just as a form of entertainment, but when they become a substitute for that sense of significance that a man is designed to seek in the mission of God and in the things that God has put in front of him, then they can become really dangerous. So I think understanding the soul of a man, the masculine shape, helps us see some of the common temptations that a man can fall victim to. If it's not video games, it can be things like sports. You can look at fantasy sports, for example, where a guy can get the kind of a false high off of significance that doesn't actually belong to him. Or even for the guys who are in sports, professional athletes and so on, seeking on the playing field what men in previous generations sought and won on the battlefield, and yet find, even just as men did on the battlefield, that some of those rewards don't actually satisfy them. But again, this helps us understand that direction. And then, of course, the direction of a woman's soul tends to go more in the direction, again, broad strokes, in the direction of security, in the direction of safety, in the direction of being loved, knowing that she's safe, knowing that she matters to the man that she's with. Those are things that matter to her. You do not tend to see little boys practicing wedding day when they're 6 or 7. That's not to say that getting married is all that matters to a woman, but it matters to a woman in a way that it doesn't matter to a man. It means something different to her. And there are, I have an easier time just elaborating about the shape of a masculine soul because I am a man, but on the, we could kind of reverse the other, look at the other side of the coin in all of those ways that women are inclined, the way that their insecurities are often in relational domain, the way that they can define themselves by their relationships or their lack thereof. These are all ways that we understand a woman's soul tends to be shaped by the fact that we're sons of Adam and daughters of Eve. So just want to emphasize this. I know I'm repeating it, but it's important enough. This does not excuse our sins, right? Understanding the shape of our souls does not excuse our sins, but it does help us understand the shape that our sins are going to be likely to take and the way that we need to repent. It helps us understand the grain of our souls, how we can best love and cherish one another, and loving one another in marriage might include dealing with, or often includes dealing with sin when it arises. So it's all part of the package. Let's talk about some other differences between men and women. So just kind of broad strokes, what are some of the ways that God built men and women differently? And then we can talk about some of the ways that that shows up and is reflected in marriage. So let's talk about physical differences between men and women. By and large, men tend to be stronger. Yeah, that's just, I mean, higher muscle mass. That is just a fact of life. Which is why the whole transgender sports thing is so controversial. Because men, this is why men's and women's sports are historically separate, because men have just a different physical makeup than women do. This is very likely what Peter was referring to in 1 Peter 3 when he referred to women as the weaker vessel. And so historically, this has meant positively that men are the ones who step up to do the hard jobs with their bodies. Why men go to war. Why men, if there's a hard job to be done, why typically is men who are first in line. Now, it doesn't mean women also can't work hard and don't have incredible strength. And if you look throughout history, the housework that a lot of women were doing was often incredibly physical. You know, there weren't dishwashers. If you wanted meat, you had to butcher a pig. There was just lots of work. But in terms of strength, men have a clear advantage. I'm sure that was, as long as there have been pickle jars, there have been husbands opening pickle jars. And wives saying, I loosened it up for you first. now flipping around, sinfully, what does a man's broad strokes, greater strength, sinfully, that shows up, or how can that be used? And the answer is something I wish we didn't have to talk about, but it's physical abuse, right? Men have sinful, wicked, cowardly men have used their physical strength to their advantage to overpower their wife, to force her to do what they want or to hurt her. And so that's, again, where we see that these creational differences can be used to serve or to harm. That's going to be a theme that we're going to return to throughout tonight. And there's no excuse for that. There's absolutely no excuse for a husband using his strength to hurt or to coerce his wife. That's one example, strength, physical strength. We talk about hormonal differences. We have different hormones. Now, we actually have the same, I want to be careful here that I don't say something that's not true. My understanding is that both men and women have some of the same hormones, but it's the percentage. So I believe that women do have testosterone in their bodies, but in a far lower amount. And is it also true that men have estrogen? It's just in way less amounts? That I'm not sure about. But I'm not, in case no one could tell, I'm not a doctor. But let's, one of the things that's interesting with testosterone, what does testosterone do for a man? What's it actually do? I mean, obviously, besides just, you know, making you go through puberty, making your voice get lower and all that. Let's say once that's all happened, what does testosterone do for a man? And other than make him want to reproduce, we'll just leave that out of the picture for now because we know that's obvious. But other than that, what does testosterone do? Does anyone know? So It makes, well, there are numbers of things, but one of the things is it makes men more willing to take risks and to do dangerous things because it makes men stupid. So literally, one of the things that testosterone does is it increases a man's capacity to do dangerous things without being fully aware of all of the effects of that. So that's why, as long as there's been men and women, there's been wives saying, "Honey, are you sure that you should do that?" And husbands saying, "It's fine." Okay, that's testosterone. Now, there are clear advantages to the fact that God did not make both men and women with equal amounts of this risk-taking capacity, because we'd all be dead. All of us, every single one of us would be dead right now. Dads and moms would be throwing their kids up in the air way higher than they should go, saying, "It's fine." You know? So the fact that women do not have this strange chemical in their bodies, and they're saying, "Honey, are you sure?" That's good. That's part of, I understand, that's part of God's good design. And also the fact that men are like, "It's fine." It's that, you know, men have said, "It's fine," all the way to the moon, literally all the way to Antarctica, all the way to the depths of Africa, right? Like, men's capacity to take stupid risks has been an important part of us subduing the earth, right? And yet there wouldn't be anybody left to rule if it also wasn't for the more cautious, I'm not so sure this is a good idea that many times husbands would do well to listen to. So there's some practical effects of some of the differences between men and women. Looking through history, this is super interesting. I know I brought this up last time. I mentioned that, and does anyone remember how I mentioned before the Industrial Revolution? So that's basically the whole creation of factories that started in the 1700s. Before that, most people worked a lot closer to home. There wasn't as thick of a line in between men's and women's work. And I actually mentioned that we have examples of cookbooks being marketed to men before the Industrial Revolution. So I want to offer a brief correction on something. So broad strokes, yes, that is true. That before we created factories, and everybody worked outside of the home, and men would go off to work and come back. Before that happened, some men would go work for other people, but many more men worked closer to home. The home was the unit of production. The home, whether you were a butcher or a baker or had a shop or were a farmer, the home tended to be the center of production. And there was not as thick of a line between men's and women's work. So women and men could alternate things throughout history. So, for example, the production of alcohol was an important part of pre-industrial culture, because that's how you preserved drink and actually had a source of sugar throughout the winter months. So, like, kids drank beer, and actually it was important because you got essential nutrients in beer that you didn't get any other way. And so brewing was a very important part of many pre-industrial cultures. Both men and women could do it. They could swap off and on depending on kind of which period of time you look at. We have examples of journals of men who recorded very carefully when their children were born, when their children were weaned, and which means they're not breastfed anymore. And so dads were involved with their kids. Women were doing hard work, so the line wasn't that thick. I have a very clear memory of reading an article online about this whole cookbook thing that I'd mentioned. When I went back to try and find that and actually went down a rabbit hole of the history of cookbooks, it was quite literally fascinating history, I couldn't actually find any evidence for that. So I want to retract that statement just because I can't find evidence for it. And what I found in my research is that prior to the Industrial Revolution, it is still true that the majority of cooking at home was done by women, but that is simply the case that childbearing and caring for those children, and even if I can be as graphic as to say menstruation, which was more of a bigger deal in prior but before the modern age, those things tended to keep more women closer to home. And so if there was someone who was going to prepare supper for the family, it made sense that it would be the wife. And most men were not cooking for their families. But it's not so much that it was like, well, that's women's work. It's just, that's just what made sense to do. Men were more often the professional cooks who would go cook for the Lord or the king or something like that. But there are clear differences because of women being generally closer to home, because childbearing was so important, and child rearing and nursing and just some of those practical things. Men tended to be the explorers and the adventurers and the soldiers and the going out and doing things. So the dad's going away to do things and the mom staying closer to home wasn't as dramatic, perhaps, but it is a pattern that persists pretty strongly throughout history. I think we should be careful about saying, well, that's just the way it's supposed to be. But at the same time, I think we can see that some of this is just built into the practical realities of how God made us. But it's very interesting in Titus chapter 2, when Titus says that the older women are to train the younger women to be working at home. When we read those words today, what are the words that jump out at us and make us go, whoa? Two words. At home, right? What do you mean at home? What's interesting is in the culture in which that was originally written, generally wives would have been at home because it was just dangerous to be out and about. It was not a safe world, and there were predators of all sorts all over the place. And so this practice of sequestering, of wives staying at home, was very common. And so the word that would have jumped out at them from that sentence was the word working. Do you see Paul addressing this theme of feminine idleness in the letters to the Thessalonians, where he talks, or is that 1 Timothy? My wires are getting crossed here, but about the women who are not busy, but busy bodies going from house to house. There's some stuff in the pastorals about false teachers targeting women who were an easier target in the sense that they would have just had more time generally on their hands if they were just at home and they, you know, the false teachers knew where they were and could do these house calls. So the command wasn't so much that they be at home. That was more of a given. The command was that they be working, that they not be idle. So there are some of these patterns that persist to the present day. I think we can see them extend through history. They're part of the way God made us. We want to be careful at saying this is the way it must be. But I think it's easier for us to say this is generally the way it should be. If someone's going to go, if someone has to go work outside the home to earn an income, it makes sense that that would be the dad, just because of the way that we're designed, and vice versa. At any point here, feel free to interrupt and say stuff and ask questions. Just practically. Throughout history, maybe I'll actually skip that sentence. Might come back to that. We talk about emotional differences between men and women. It is a fact that estrogen affects a woman's mood in non-linear ways, and that is just a fact. Men tend to be far less, now this gets into brain differences here, men tend to be way less intuitive, right? So men like, whoa, this is going on? How come you didn't make it clear to me? And the wife saying, it's been super clear to everybody. Why didn't you pick up on this? Okay, that's some of that's just part of our brain. But women can be far more intuitive, but estrogen can have effects on a woman's emotions that can affect her in profound ways. So those are some differences that kind of go back to some of the hormonal differences. brain differences. Really, really, really interesting. There's all these stereotypes about the differences between men and women. And for years, you had all kinds of scientists saying, these are just stereotypes. That's all they are. They're just stereotypes. And when we look at a woman's brain and a man's brain under a microscope, they're the same brain. Well, you know, recently, and by recently, I mean like 2017 recently, we're doing more advanced studies that are showing us, you know what? There are subtle but important differences between a man's brain and a woman's brain that line up with the stereotypes, like really on point. It just is. I'm working off of an article here I got from Stanford Medical School, about some neural imaging studies that they did there. Here's some differences between men and women. So, one difference is that men tend to have more connections between the front and the back part of our brains. Women tend to have more connections between the left and the right side of their brains. Practically, what this does provide is a bit of a neurological basis for this idea that men are like waffles and women are like spaghetti. How many of you have no idea what I mean by waffles and spaghetti? Okay. Does somebody here want to explain what waffles and spaghetti are? No, that's very true. So you look up waffles and spaghetti on YouTube, there's this comedian that does a pretty funny bit about it. But yeah, man, there's this, and then there's this, and then there's this. These boxes. And with women, those boxes have connections between them, and they tend to be connected. And this is one of those differences that has a neurological basis, and it's one of those differences that needs to be respected. Because it's easy for a man to look at a woman and say, why are we talking about my mother all of a sudden, when a moment ago we were talking about the car, and a moment before that we were talking about groceries? Like what's going on? What's wrong with you? And a wife can say to her husband, why are we still talking about that? This is so obviously connected to this and this and this. What's wrong with you that you can't see that? And what we just need to understand is that these are differences that God, to some respect, not to say we can't grow past them or grow in our understanding, but to a certain extent are sort of differences in the way that we're wired. And these are ways that we can understand each other and help each other. It can be helpful sometimes for a husband to say, honey, I think we should just finish figuring this out before we move on to everything else that's bothering you. Let's just deal with this. And it can be helpful for a wife to say to her husband, these are all the things that are, and I think they actually are connected. Or just, here's what's going on in my heart, and I got to just tell you, this is going on, and this is going on, and then this seems to be connected to this, and this makes me think about this. And for a husband to not go, wow, that's weird, but hey, that's how you work. You're different, and I care about you, and I want to help you with that. So it's not like one is better or worse. I'm sure people who have thought about this more than me have probably describe that there are certain situations in which waffle thinking, box thinking is really helpful. And there are certain situations in which spaghetti thinking, it's all connected, is really helpful. And it's where we need each other. Women tend to excel verbally. So there's actually some pretty big arguments here that have been made for separate education of boys and girls. That's why, like, in a lot of, like, the, you know, you think of the British school children, sort of that old school classical education, boys and girls were educated in different rooms. And there's some good arguments to be made for that based upon the way that our brains develop and simply work. Women tend to excel verbally. So girls tend to speak earlier and better than boys. And women as a whole tend to have better verbal gifts than men, except when it comes to verbal analogies, which is really interesting. So more men tend to be able to do a better job of saying, well, this is kind of like this, making analogies. Here's a quote. I was going to actually quote from this article a little bit. Reading comprehension and writing ability, this is of women, consistently exceed that of men on average. They outperform, so women outperform men in tests of fine motor coordination and perceptual speed. They're more adept at retrieving information from long-term memory. Men, on average, can more easily juggle items in working memory. They have superior visuospatial skills. They're better at visualizing what happens when a complicated two- or three-dimensional shape is rotated in space, at correctly determining angles from the horizontal, at tracking moving objects, and at aiming projectiles. In adulthood, women remain more oriented to faces, men to things. Okay, now again, these are broad strokes. There are going to be individual exceptions. There are, so you think about aiming projectiles, so as a whole, men will be better shots, let's say with the gun or with archery than with women. But there are women who are clear exceptions to that, and there are men who couldn't shoot the broadside of a barn, right? So there are individual exceptions. This is talking about broad strokes in general over a large sample size. Here's some of the ways that these differences in our brains, and I'm not going into all the science-y differences about this part is bigger and smaller, but just these are just sort of the effects of that. Women are twice as likely as men to experience clinical depression in their lifetimes. Likewise for post-traumatic stress disorder. Men are twice as likely to become alcoholic or drug dependent, and 40% more likely to develop schizophrenia. Boys' dyslexia rate is perhaps 10 times that of girls, and they're 4 or 5 times as likely to get a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. Why is all this important? Why are we talking about this? What does this have to do with marriage? We've touched on this a little bit, but why does all this matter? Because what's our temptation right away when someone has a different perspective than us is just to, yeah, that's not how I see it, therefore you're wrong. Well, that's not how I see it, because actually a very wise and good creator made you to see things differently than I see it. That's kind of how we should think. That's not how I see it, and I'm so glad that's not how I see it, because I need your perspective and you need my perspective. And let's come at this together, each with the unique way that God has made us, and bring a fully orbed perspective to this that is so much better than what just one of us on our own would see. That's the kind of way that husbands and wives should talk to each other. Not, that's weird, but man, that's valuable. Or, I'm not sure that's helpful at times, right? Because it's not just a blank check to be like, well, you're a woman, so everything you say is okay, any more than that's true for men. But it really helps us to understand these differences that are given to us by a wise and a good creator. Other thoughts on this? What does this have to do with marriage? Why are these differences important for us to think through? Do these differences make marriage more challenging? Could that be part of the point? I think so. I think that if we take some of perhaps the body analogy from scripture and apply it to marriage, how different parts of the body need each other, and how it is and maybe I'm going a little bit beyond here what the text of Scripture says, but I think this is a pretty clear implication of what the text says, that loving someone who is different than you is really profoundly good for you. It is very good and helpful to look at someone who's not like you, who's different than you, and say, God made you, and I'm going to love you, even though you're very difficult to figure out right now. That does something to us. That has a profound effect on us. And there's a bit of an analogy here, as we talked about last year, to the fact that God designed child rearing to be this long, drawn-out process, you know, where you look at human development compared to animal development and how animal development is just like boom, 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 right? I'd be like a great grandparent by now if I was an animal and my kids would not need to be still told to do the most basic things on repeat. But that process of doing that shapes us, right? So when God says to the people of Israel, teach these things to your children constantly, repeatedly, that's good, not just for your kids, that's good for you to do that. And I think in an analogous way, in marriage, loving someone who's different than you, it is profoundly good for us. It shapes us. It impacts us. It causes us to come out of ourselves. I just know that practically how I experienced this was that even before Amy and I were married, but just about a year that we spent from the time that we went out for our first cup of coffee together to when we got engaged was, 13 months. And in that time, as I really struggled to figure out this person whom I loved and could not figure out, that shaped me in such a way that some other people who were closer to me said, you know, Chris, like you're a much, I forget exactly the words, but the gist of it was you're a better person to spend time with than you were a year ago. And when you hear that, you're kind of like, well, thanks. But on the other hand, you go, no, I actually get that. It's coming out of ourselves to love someone who is different than us shapes us. It's one of the ways that God sanctifies us. And I think those clash moments in marriage where we're saying, this, you are so different than me, what is going on right now, are golden opportunities for us to lay down our lives, our preferences, our sense of, come on, let's just do this my way right now. And that has a sanctifying effect on our souls. Can anyone testify to that? Right. The more you help each other see things from different perspectives and challenge each other. You know, sometimes people talk about marriage like being like a couple of stones in a rock tumbler, kind of knocking each other's rough edges off. Maybe that's a part of it, but it's almost like actually the more you tumble around, the more you grow. And so then the rock tumbler, we got to get rid of that. What would be another... Come on, men here, we're supposed to be good at verbal analogies, okay? So what's an analogy where you got two things, and as they bump into each other, they make each other grow in really helpful ways? Okay, women, you're allowed to suggest something too. I don't know, maybe they're like magic rocks, I don't know. Whatever, let's skip the analogy piece, but that is a little bit of what happens in marriage. Let's talk practically, and just maybe you might think this is kind of sideways for a second, but I think this is one of the reasons why God is against homosexuality. And because I've heard people say, you know, how can homosexuality be so wrong if someone is choosing it for themselves And it's what makes them most happy. And they will talk about those gay couples that you see that have been together for years. And they're just so happy and so peaceful with one another. And they just have this great relationship. And it's not about going out and being promiscuous. It's just they just have this quiet life together. I can picture that. Like I've known some couples, or one couple that I'm thinking of in particular, who they were a gay couple, and you watch them together, and it's like, yeah, they get along super well. And I think that's actually part of the problem. You hear what I'm saying? It is, if it's a man to a man, or if it's a woman to a woman, they will just naturally get the other person in a way that a man and a woman won't. It's going to be way easier. And I think that's actually part of what God doesn't want. Because, and I'm not saying that's the only reason, there are other reasons why there's just an unnaturalness to it. But there is a sense in which there is maybe something more natural. If you follow me here for a moment. I think two men or two women in some ways are going to be able to get each other a bit more naturally than a man and a woman will. But in the process, there is something that doesn't happen, which is that coming out of yourself to love someone who is very different than you, and the way that profoundly challenges selfishness and profoundly shapes your soul. So I think, here's what I'm saying, there is a physical naturalness to a man and a woman coming together in marriage. There are some aspects of it relationally that feel very unnatural. But that's God's design, because that's where He does some of His best work in us. Don't need to beat this point to death, but I think it's important. Before we move on to talk about submission and authority, which is where what we're finally going to get to, does anyone else have any other kind of comment, question, story, anything about just differences between men and women that is relevant to marriage? Open floor. I'm going to get another drink of water. I'm really thirsty for some reason, which you didn't need to know. But that keeps it interesting. So back when Amy and I were dating, I could find out something new about her whenever I wanted, because there's so much we didn't know. We could go for a date and I'd just be like, tell me about this or tell me about that. So it's kind of like on demand, you'd find out something new. After you've been married for a length of years, you can't just do that on demand, because you've asked all those questions. And so instead, the new things that you figure out about the other person surprise you. Like, you can't plan for them. They come, but they're there. So I'd say I don't know how often this, but every so often, when I'm least expecting it, something will come up, or Amy will say something where it's like, I didn't know that about you before, or that really took me by surprise. And it's awesome. And it's the fact that you can't predict when it's going to come that keeps it kind of really interesting. It's like bird watching. You don't know when that really unique bird is going to land there. And all the birds are beautiful, but every once in a while there's one you've never seen before. And you go, man, that's just beautiful and mysterious. Are those your words that you use, Jason? Yeah. And keep that. Those of you who are married or will be married, keep that curiosity alive. It goes a long way. We're going to talk about submission now. This is often where discussions about men and women in marriage, where husbands and wives start, And I've deliberately saved it till the end. Now it's still, we'll take about an hour on this, but deliberately saved it for this point because I've wanted us to see that wives submit to your husbands, husbands submit to your wives is not about God just randomly picking, someone's got to call the shot, so I guess it'll be him. But there are beautiful and profound differences between men and women, and there are reasons for the way that God has made us, and then I'll use the word roles here that He's given us, but those roles are based in design. So being a man and a woman in marriage is more than submission and authority, but it is not less. So there are three times in the New Testament where in the epistles, married people are directly addressed and they are told how to be married. Okay, so there's truth about marriage that can be learned from all kinds of places in the New Testament. So we can learn about marriage in many different facets. But three times in particular, when an epistle, a letter to a group of Christians, directly addresses married people and says, married people, here's what you got to do. Ephesians chapter 5, Colossians chapter 3, and 1 Peter chapter 3. And all three places, wives are given essentially the same command, and husbands are given various shades of essentially the same command. So let's just read these scriptures together. We're going to save Ephesians 5 for last, because we're going to spend the most time there. But let's read these scriptures together, chat about them for a little bit, then we'll take a 5-minute break, and then we'll kind of let this percolate, and then we'll come back and talk about it. But can someone, so it's 1 Peter 3, 1 to 7, it's a bit of a longer passage. Colossians 3, 18 to 19, and then Ephesians 5, 22 to 33. So it would be fantastic if three people could just read those passages. Let's start with 1 Peter, let's go to Colossians, and then we'll end with Ephesians 5. So if someone's got 1 Peter 3, 1 to 7. So, command to submit is there for wives and both, and 1 Peter, live with your wives in an understanding way, and do not be harsh with them. So not worded the same, but the same general direction of instruction is given. Okay, and then someone, big one, Ephesians 5, 22 to 33.
Christ, so also the wives should submit to their husbands. Husbands, love your wife, like your wife,
When I will do premarriage counseling with the couple in the past, what I would have them do is read Ephesians 5:22-23 and have the man read the parts addressed to wives, and I would have the wife read the parts addressed to husbands. And then I would ask them, was there any struggle or tension in your heart when the other person read the part for you? And what do you think some of the common answers that I would sometimes get would be? Yeah. So why do you think a man might struggle with hearing his fiance read, "Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church"? Why would your average 21st century dude struggle with that? Okay. Being a man, I was thinking a bit simpler than that. I think that's wise. I think you're onto something. I think it's the "don't tell me what to do" thing. Okay. So I think that's one of the reasons, right? There's this. So this goes to some of the design creational things where men tend to think in terms of got to accomplish a task, and there's this desire to be competent at it, but sinfully that manifests itself in "I got this." I don't need to check the map. I'm fine, right? And when someone else tells them how to do something that they think they know how to do, that's a big challenge for a man who thinks he's got it all figured out.
I know.
That's my part. Don't read my part. I got this. So there's just, I think it's sin, but it's common sin. And why might a wife struggle hearing her husband read, "Wives, submit to your husbands"? Why might a wife struggle with that? I don't think the answer is feminism. Okay. Now, we have to face up to the legacy of feminism, and we're going to do that when we talk about this later on after our break here. Feminism has shaped us all in profound ways, ways that we're not even aware of. But what we should understand is that feminism is not the problem. Feminism is a symptom of a deeper problem. The problem that goes all the way back to the curse in Genesis 3. Your desire will be for your husband. Your desire will be contrary to him, but he will rule over you, right? There's this, the struggle of the curse has manifested itself in various ways throughout history. It was very interesting when I was listening to, back when I listened to a lot of John MacArthur, and he was preaching on one of these passages. And he spent like a good 20-25 minutes of his sermon going through history And just looking at all of the various quasi-feminist movements throughout history, where the roles, the design for men and women has been inverted, and just how ugly and disastrous it's been. He just kind of went through and was reading all this stuff. And just by the end, you're kind of like, ugh. And he's like, so why have I read all this? He's like, I just want you to know, if you disagree with me, whose side you're on. And of course, everyone laughs. It's just classic Johnny Mac. But there is something to it where feminism, particularly third wave feminism that we're experiencing more of the effects of these days, was kind of three main waves to feminism, right? First wave feminism was largely about the right to vote and own property. Second wave feminism in the 70s was more about emancipation from the home and working outside the home and reproductive freedom and so on. Third wave feminism, which is, we might call it Spice Girls feminism, which is, it's a little bit harder to put handles on, but it's some of the differences might be second wave feminism would have really objected to the sexualization of women. Third wave feminism embraces the sexualization of women as a tool to get men to do what they want. And so it's just sort of the more modern feminism that many of us live under. It's, you know, Beyonce feminism, you know, the image of Beyonce standing on a stage dressed clearly in a way to attract the male gaze with the word feminist behind her on the screen. Just the irony of that, that's kind of a bit of a taste of third wave feminism. But these waves of feminism are simply waves that go all the way back to the Garden of Eden, of Satan's assault on God's good design for men and women. And so this struggle is in the heart of every man and every woman. That's why it's in God's word, because we need it. And we need to see that it's good. We need to hear these words, and we need to so hear them that when we hear someone else, be it our spouse or a fiance or someone else, read the words that are for us, that instead of going, ugh, we go, oh, that's good. And I want to try to, if we're not there, try to help us move in that direction at least tonight. But first, we're going to take a little break. It's 8:36. Let's take a 4-minute break. We'll start up at 8:40 again. So help yourself to some cookies that are at the back that my lovely wife made. And meet back here in just a few. So, Colossians 3, 1 Peter 3, Ephesians 5. We could sum this up by saying that God has given husbands a responsibility to care for and protect their wives in a particular way, and God has given wives the instructions to submit to their husbands. What I want us to see from God's word is that these two commands given to men and women, given to husbands and wives, are related to each other. So this is not like wives submit to your husbands and husbands pick up 2 liters of milk from the grocery store, right? You get your command and you get your command, and they're not connected to each other. What I think we need to see is that the authority that a husband has over his wife, which is implied by saying wives submit to your husbands, right? When you have to submit to someone, they have authority over you. The authority that a husband has over his wife is for the sake of taking care of her, that she might flourish and be nourished. Okay, so these are not just two random connections. You should do this, and oh, while you're at it, you should do this. They're two sides of the same coin. And I think where we actually see this is in the discussion of a different level, a different type, a different context of authority, but authority nonetheless, back in 2 Samuel chapter 5 and then 2 Samuel chapter 23. These are verses, passages about the reign of David the king. And can someone go to 2 Samuel 23 and someone else 2 Samuel 5? And someone can just read 2 Samuel 5, 12. And then someone else, 23:3-4. This is about the authority of a king over his nation. So different in a lot of ways, but just if you listen carefully here, you'll see where we're going. 2 Samuel 5:12. Anyone got that? So God had established his throne, had made him king, and had established his throne for the sake of who? For the sake of his people Israel. Why had God given Israel a king? Was it for the king's sake? It was for the nation's sake. And then 23:3-4. Anyone, please. 2 Samuel 23:3-4. That's it. Okay. So think of just this poetic thing that's being described. When the sun rises on a cloudless morning and shines, you know, this is like the golden hour when photographers would love to be out and catch the sun shining on the glistening glass. Like this is the glistening grass. This is just beautiful. It's just a picture of beauty. And when you're there, you just go, ah, this is wonderful. I want to be here. This is good. That's what it's like when a king rules over his people in justice. See, the authority that a king has over his people is for their benefit, for their sake, for their good. It is a wonderful thing to be enjoyed and to be received. Authority is for the sake of the nourishing and the flourishing of those over whom you have authority. And I think that we can see in these three marriage passages in the New Testament that the same is true. God has given husbands authority over their wives, not for their sake, that the husbands might benefit from it, but for the sake of their wives, that their wives might flourish under it. And I think understanding this takes away much of the tension that we have with the issue of authority, much of this stiffening of the back that we feel when I'm supposed to submit to him, when we understand that that's not what authority is for, is that that person would benefit from our service to them, but vice versa, that we would benefit from their service to us as they serve us by and with their authority. This is not how authority tends to be used in the world, right? Even when the king, the idea of the king was first being introduced to Israel, what did Samuel say? What's your king going to do? He's going to tax you. He's going to benefit from you. He's going to benefit from this. That's what kings tend to do. Sadly, this is what authority, what people with authority tend to do with that authority, right? You get the corner office, you get the perks, you get the benefits, and you make people do what you want them to do, and authority is for your benefit. What did Jesus say to his disciples? He talked about the lords of the Gentiles, the rulers of the Gentiles who lord it over them, right? That's what a sinful use of authority is. I have authority over you, so you're going to do what I want so that this benefits me. And we've all been exposed to that type of authority. But biblical authority is reversed. It says, I am here with authority that you might be protected, that you might flourish, that you might be nourished. And so that's why it's two sides of the same coin when God says, wives, submit to your husbands. Husbands, love your wives. Wives, submit to your husbands. Husbands, do not be harsh with them. Wives, submit to your husbands. Husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way. Because that's what this is for. And Ephesians 5 just really fleshes this out in, pun not intended, in some really beautiful ways. And this just really jumped out at me when we were preaching through those couple of weeks in Colossians a few weeks ago. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by washing of the water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy without blemish. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. No one ever hated his own flesh. We talked about this idea, and I'll repeat it here in this context, that when a husband marries his wife, and particularly when he consummates that relationship physically, there is a very real sense in which his wife has become a part of him. She's now his body in a very real sense, which is symbolized by the physical act. And this is why sex is for marriage, because it's literally not just like, oh, I don't want you to have fun until marriage, but no, this is what it is a picture of, is this unity and this union. And from that moment on, a husband has taken responsibility to care for his wife as if for his own body, because she is a part of his own body now. He is her head. She is his body. And he must nourish and cherish her as his own flesh, because there's a very real sense in which she is a part of his own flesh. Going just to see the beautiful poetry now, bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh, and how that is then brought back together in covenant union, in sexual intercourse. It's beautiful. And that's what authority is for. So this, what does authority look like? It does not look like you go do this so that this helps me out. It's about I'm going to do this and we're going to do this because I have your best interests in mind. Authority is about the husband putting on the heavy backpack, putting on the bulletproof vest, and going to do the hard things to protect his wife. Once again, before we just move on here, I just want to acknowledge that there's something about this that is just baked into our souls. You want to know one of the most successful chick flicks in the last, I don't know if I'm going to get the dates right here, I want to say 10 years, but maybe it's been longer. Let's say 15 years. One of the most successful, widely viewed chick flicks in the past, let's say 15 years. Can anyone want to kind of guess what I'm thinking of? It's the movie Taken, right? With Liam Neeson, about the girl who gets kidnapped and her dad gets on the phone with her kidnappers and says, I have a very particular set of skills and I will find you and I will... You know, what's the line? I haven't seen the movie, but it's a brutally, I haven't watched it, okay, but I probably should at some point. It's a brutally violent movie about this girl's dad just like killing all of these guys who have tried to capture her into sex slavery and or into trafficking. But it's the fact that this man is using all of his masculine energy, all of that testosterone, risk-taking, I'm just going to go in with guns blazing, to come and rescue her. And you, like the audience of people who were buying tickets for Taken apparently was like women disproportionately high. Because it's this, now I'm not saying it's a great movie, I haven't seen it, I can't recommend it. But this idea of a man in all of his masculine strength using it to protect a woman whom he loves. In this case, I believe it's his daughter. There's something about that speaks so profoundly to us. And in marriage, this is what it's all about. So what does submission and authority practically look like in marriage? And I don't think it's actually all that complicated. So I've heard people say that this should largely operate on the level of initiative, that husbands should be the ones primarily taking initiative to make sure that things are happening. So I've heard the encouragement, you know, husbands, use the word let's. Like, be the one to suggest things. Say, let's do this, honey. I've got this idea. Make sure that the conversations are happening. Be thinking ahead. Thinking ahead of what would be best for our family. Having a vision for your family. What should we be doing for vacation this summer? How should we be raising and disciplining our kids? And all of that. And I'm not going to say that that's not a good thing. I'm sure that many wives would love their husbands to take more initiative. And there is something that we could say about Adam on planet Earth as a man by himself. He's going to need initiative. There's something very masculine promote initiative taking. And yes, husbands should take initiative in their marriages. But I'm not sure that that's at the heart of what's going on here. Because, what if, for example, a man is in a marriage where, he is just simply not a very creative person who's thinking about these kinds of things, and his wife just more naturally is. Is she just supposed to keep it buttoned and wait for him to bring things up? I don't think it says wives wait for your husbands to bring things up. I think it says submit to them, and I don't think submitting means waiting for them to bring things up. You hear what I'm saying? So we can't take the good idea that husbands should take initiative more because their wives will feel honored and loved that way, and make that at the essence of what's going on in submission. I don't think that's true. I think the essence of submission is submission. Namely, that the buck stops with husbands when it comes to making decisions for what's going to happen in the marriage and with the family. The buck stops with the husband. The final responsibility and the final decisions rest with him. But this is not for his own benefit, but for the benefit of his wife. So I'm going to tell a story here, and I hesitate with the story because I don't want it to sound like I'm the example and we've got this all figured out, which is not true. But this is one day where in retrospect, I think we saw this working itself out. So we were having some vacation days, well, some staycation days. We were here in Nipawin. I was off work for a few days and in the summer. When it comes to ideas of what we should do with our family, my wife tends to be far more creative than I am. So she came one morning and said, Chris, what do you say tomorrow we go to Melfort, and she had some ideas of some things that we were going to do in Melfort, and then we come back, and she had this kind of plan. I said, what do you think about that? And I said, that's a good idea. Let's do that. So who made the final decision? Who's responsible? Right? It's not, submission is not about rights. It's about responsibilities. Who is responsible to make the decision that we would execute this plan? I was, and I made that decision. So we did the plan, and now I don't remember the details. I just remember it didn't actually work out all that okay. And we were in the car on the way back, and Amy said, man, that actually wasn't that great of a plan for the day. I'm sorry, she said. And I corrected her because I said, you should not be sorry. Yes, you came up with the plan, but who is responsible for the fact that we went to Melfort to do this today? I am. I made the decision because I'm the husband in the family. And that's, so when I said, yes, let's go do that, it's my decision. So if it goes bad, whose fault is it? It's my fault, right? So all the guys who are like, yeah, I get to have authority in my marriage are all of a sudden like, oh, that means it's my fault when things go bad. But that's precisely it, right? This is part of what I mean by carrying the heavy backpack is that you carry the load of the responsibility for that decision, and Amy gets to just have the load lifted from her shoulders and think, okay, well, that's my husband's responsibility or his fault. We carry that on ourselves. And that's just a little example of a case in which a husband properly carrying authority, and I'm not saying I do this perfectly all the time by a long shot, but I think in that particular instance where authority lifts the burden from Amy's shoulders, frees her to be creative and make suggestions and operate as my helper and help with the way that our family operates. She's not sitting there thinking, well, I've got this great idea for what we could do tomorrow, but I'm not going to say anything until Chris brings it up. That's just silliness. But the buck stops with me, and when things go bad, it's my fault. I don't get to say, well, that was a bad idea, because I made the decision that we would do that. Even if implicitly it looks like, I think to an outside observer, they might think that we're just sort of making it together. And she says, what do you think about this? And I say, well, yeah, let's do that. right? So it's not like we have to like have this like formal ceremony when we make a decision, where it's like, I hereby declare as the husband of this family that that is what we shall do. No, it's just, I just say, yeah, let's do that. But we understand, because we've had to work it out in some particular instances, that the final decision rested with me, therefore the final responsibility rested with me. There are other times where I've had to be a bit more direct with submission. And there's another story that comes up. Again, I hesitate to tell stories. It's just that I'm more familiar with my stories than other people's. So this was early on in our marriage. We were having a baby shower for Judah, and it involved a group of people where there was some weird stuff going on with the relationship. And there was a kind of a private baby shower that was going to be hosted at someone's house. And this group of people was kind of going to show up and hijack the baby shower a little bit to push an agenda, kind of wreck the whole thing and make things very uncomfortable for everyone involved. So I still can almost remember the look on Amy's face as she comes. Okay, so she's just had a baby. Her emotions are all over the map. And she just would love nothing more than to have our child be celebrated by these people, and yet it's going to turn into this big tense thing. And she just came to me and she said, what do I do? And what I said is, you're not going. So I very seldom will say things that directly, but I just said to her, you're not going to the baby shower. Why do you think I said that way? So that's the second step. First step is I'm just taking it off of her shoulders about like what do I do with this like really tense thing that's going on? Well, your husband says you're not going, okay? So you don't have to worry about it. Number two, it's my fault. So I'm the bad guy, right? So that's the responsibility piece. I'm the bad guy. She can say, I'm sorry. And like so part of it is I said this knowing like this was not going to be a good thing, and she didn't want to go. But it's like, I have to go. Your husband says you're not allowed to go. So I'm going to get in trouble, and she's free. So that's the heavy burden lifted off, put on my shoulders. And then once we kind of both took a breath, I said, okay, now that we've got that out of the way, let's try and figure out how we can actually make this work where you could go. But just so you know, if it's going to be like this, you don't have to worry about going, and it's on my shoulders. So then we figured out, and we said, well, what if you called this person and said, you know, and whatever. And it's not like I had to be the one making those phone calls. Like, my wife is an extremely competent adult, far more competent than I am in many ways. And she was able to call up this person and say, do you think that we could maybe do it this way? And it all worked out fine. But the point is, if none of that had happened, and if it had been this thing of putting Amy in a really vulnerable spot, as her husband, it was my responsibility to protect her. And my authority was a gift to her in that moment to do that. Now, in case I need to repeat it again, not done that perfectly time and time again, but I think those types of situations are key case studies for where authority really shines and where it is really where the value of it as something that protects a wife really, really shines out. Got more to say here, but Amy, you're here tonight, and can you just, how do you feel about the fact that God has given me authority over you? And there's all kinds of feminists in the world who would say, coward, weakling. I think what you just heard out of her mouth is just godliness, right? And a woman's soul saying, I'm safe, right? Do you hear that word safe? Like, I just, you know, I didn't feed her that word. No, she says that every time I ask her that, but I never told her. Okay. Say, I feel safe. Yeah. No, I. Hey, Siri, tell my wife to. No, I. So that didn't happen. But when we do pre-marriage thing together, I ask her that. She says that, and I've never told her to say that, but that's, you just see the shape of a woman's soul, and the fact that the buck stops with me. But Amy, do you ever feel like I squelch your creativity to suggest things and plan things and and have a voice in the shape of our marriage and our family. Okay. I didn't tell her to say that either. Hey. But sometimes I said maybe we could be done at Valley Village. So, yeah. Okay. So I'm just trying to say here that I think by God's grace, our marriage, imperfectly as it has experienced some of this blessing where the authority that God has given me over my wife, God has helped me to grow in using it, not for my benefit, but for hers. Now, with all of that being said, there is another issue here. It takes courage for a husband to exercise authority over his wife, to exercise his God-given authority over her, particularly at times where he needs to tell her no to something that she wants to do. And there is a type of, I'm going to use the word complementarian here, which again refers to this, men's and women's roles are complementary. There is a type of complementarian that pays lip service to the fact that husbands have authority over their wives and wives should submit to their husbands, pays lip service to that, but basically says that a husband asking his wife to submit to him is kind of like the break glass and pull handle thing. Like, you might have to use it like once or twice in a decade, but practically, you know, it doesn't really have an effect in your day-to-day marriage. That's probably how I operated for probably the first number of years in our marriage. There were many times where I simply lacked the confidence because I hadn't been trained and shown how. I lacked the confidence to really operate in our marriage as the man of the house. And I think far too often in the early stages of our marriage, I would say, I need to make a decision. Honey, what should we do? And she would say something. I'd say, okay, we're going to do that. Okay, so technically the buck stopped with me, but I was putting in very little sweat into actually thinking about what we're going to do. And so this, I'm bringing back now that, yeah, some of that initiative piece really is important. As time has gone on, I have had to grow in stepping into my God-given role and understanding, no, like, I need to be a husband and a father in every respect in this marriage. And I need to say, you know what? I actually think we should do this. And actually make decisions at times that my wife disagrees with. I'm kind of being a little bit funny by kind of whispering it like this, because I think my experience tells me that there are many Christian marriages where that never happens. Do you think I'm right? Because they might pay lip service to submission, but practically the rule of the household is, if mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. Or happy wife, happy life. So the husband formally said, yeah, complimentary, yeah. But practically, he knows that if he makes a decision that she doesn't like, he's going to pay for it in some form or another. And so he just happens to conveniently decide to do whatever she already wants to do. So formally complementarian, but practically she's wearing the pants. A lot of men are cowards. And perhaps it's because their fathers were cowards. Perhaps it's because no one ever taught them to do that. But practically, in the last number of years in our marriage, I have grown in my capacity to say, I'm going to make a decision that my wife actually disagrees with, because I believe that this is the best decision for our family, the best decision for my wife. Now, I do that not glibly, like I think I know everything. But like I've shared, my wife is an incredibly competent human being. She has such a good head on her shoulders. I need her wisdom, and I have and will continue to need her perspective on things so much. So this is not about me walking around thinking I know everything. But think about this. if a husband only ever does what his wife already wants him to do, is she ever actually submitting to him? So practically, submission is actually only happening when she is acquiescing to something, which means like relenting, submitting to something that she wouldn't have done otherwise. Now, again, this is a tender thing that we got to deal with, because a husband has got to deal with this very, very carefully. If a husband is married to a wise and a godly wife, he should make decisions that she doesn't want to make, or make a decision that she disagrees with fear and trembling, right? Because, like, think about it from another perspective. God gave you that woman to be your helper, and you married her because you trust her and trust how she thinks, and you really should pay attention to what she's saying. So I'm not saying we just do this glibly, and this is about just men do whatever they want. But there are times, and maybe more often than we think, and it's going to depend and vary, and it's not about keeping score, but where a husband needs the courage to say, no, honey, we're going to do this. And a godly wife will say, okay. So interesting, honey, I'm going to put you on the spot again. I hope you're okay with that. I know you're giving me the please don't look, but have this, what I'm describing here about me having some more courage, let's say in the last 5 years, to make decisions that are different from the ones that you would have wanted. Have you noticed this the same way that I have, that I'm describing it? You think so? Okay. How have you been with it? Okay. But do you think that has our marriage suffered or grown in the last 5 years? Yeah. So guys, I want to be careful here. We didn't script this at all. I didn't tell her I was going to ask her these questions. I'm not trying to set us up as the pinnacle here. This is the marriage I'm most familiar with. Okay. My parents got divorced when I was young. I haven't really seen it. This is just what I've got to work with. I think our marriage has grown because I think while in the moment a wife may desire to do opposite of what her husband wants and might get grumpy when he makes a decision that she doesn't want to make and might be tempted to manipulate him or withdraw from him or whatever, I think long-term a godly wife is going to recognize that her husband is being courageous and taking initiative and being bold, and that's actually going to draw her to him in a closer way. So it's counterintuitive. A lot of husbands think, well, if I just limp-wristedly go with whatever she wants, we're going to have a happy marriage. You're going to have a happy marriage because you're basically acting like one of her kids. And then she's got however many kids plus one. But when you actually act like a husband, there might be some short-term struggle as she experiences some of the Genesis 3 stuff and has to remember, oh, this is why the Bible says this. But long-term is going to recognize, man, my man's actually a man. And I respect that. And I love that. And I feel more safe with that. Anyone want to make any comments about this or ask any questions about this before I keep going? Do you think we're on to something here? Do you think we're on the right track? Let me say this. A husband should not make a decision counter to his wife's preferences just because. Okay? So like, husbands who are here, or future husbands who are here, husbands who are listening, this is not permission to just say, go be contrary to your wife just because. That's stupid. Literally. Only make a decision that is different from the decision your wife would have made if you're absolutely convinced before God that it is the right decision to make. And in those situations, make that decision with courage. And I guess I don't need to say and, because that's just kind of the end of the sentence. Make that decision with courage. There are many, many times where and maybe the majority of times, if you're married to a wise and a godly woman, the majority of times where your decisions will be at the very least heavily influenced by her, and maybe perhaps more often than not will line up with the kinds of things that she would want, or where practically your decisions are going to be a confluence of your perspective and her perspective hashed out. You happen to have the final say, the buck stops with you, but the decision is one in with which you are both happy. And that should actually be the goal, right? The husband should want to, as a leader, not just say, we're going to do this because I'm the husband, but explain and help his wife understand why he's making the decision that is different from the one that she would have made. Right? That's what wise leaders do. They don't just say, we're doing this and you're going to follow me. But they say, you should come along with this decision and want to follow me because here's all the reasons why. So all of that is in place there. But I do think as time has gone on that I've just noticed that many husbands really need to develop some emotional courage, some emotional spine, some emotional backbone. An author who I have kind of a mixed relationship with, and I'm going to go ahead and tell you who it is. I could just quote him without mentioning him, but Douglas Wilson, the Moscow Doug Wilson, okay? Quite a mixed relationship with. I used to say, I only agree with 40% of what he says, but that 40% is really good. Depending on the time, you know, that number might be shrinking. it seems like more and more of what I read is just like, oh, man. But nevertheless, he has said some really helpful things about family and about marriage. One of his statements about husbands having an emotional backbone in marriage is this. He said, it might not be an exact quote, but he said, never apologize to your wife unless God thinks you've done something wrong. Now that statement blew up on social media and all kinds of people. See, there's Doug Wilson being stupid Doug Wilson. And trust me, he said enough other things that I think he should not have said. But I don't think this is one of them. And you might think we've wandered outside of authority and submission, but we haven't. So we're talking about just the emotional strength, emotional courage that a husband needs. Very often when something goes awry between a husband and a wife, or between just a man and a woman, and the woman is upset, what is going to be the knee-jerk reaction for the man to do to try to patch things up and make things right? Say, sorry, I must have done something wrong, I'm sorry. And I think this is one of the ways in which a husband hands over, relinquishes his God-given authority in a marriage, that basically his wife's emotions can rule their marriage. So he might make a decision that she doesn't want, and so she just gets upset, and then he says sorry and ends up doing what she wants just for her to be happy, right? This is kind of how it works in. And this was something that for years, because of the family that I grew up in, my family of origin, if someone was upset, you just said sorry, even if you hadn't done anything wrong. And you said sorry 40, 50 times if you had to until they were placated, and then you were back on in their good books again after 4 or 5 days. And emotions ruled the roost. And that's just not true. Emotions are not an accurate reflection of reality much of the time. And a husband needs to have the courage to say at times, not all the time, but at times to say, my wife is not happy right now, and that's not my problem. Sometimes it will be. So men, listen to this and be careful. Sometimes you will be unhappy because you've been an idiot. And then you do need to say sorry. So if God thinks, and we know what God thinks from his word, if God thinks you have done something wrong because you've been inconsiderate or you've been selfish or you've been rude or you've fill in all the dumb, sinful things that man can do, you must apologize. But if you have simply done something that is not pleasing to her and she's not happy with you, and you have not done anything wrong, you must not apologize. If you do, that is allowing emotions to rule the roost. And this can go vice versa, right? So men can do this the same, or just maybe talking in broad strokes about the direction in marriage. But I want to encourage husbands, potential husbands, old, long married husbands, to have the emotional courage to actually lead their homes. And what I have experienced and have seen others experience, and I think we will experience more, is that this is actually the path to a wife growing in her love for her husband, growing in her sense of safety with him, particularly as she sees him making decisions that are for her sake, are for her benefit. Anyone want to comment on that idea about don't say sorry unless God thinks you've done something wrong? Do you think that's wise? Do you think that's helpful? Do you struggle with that? Anyone want to comment on that? If someone's offended, they've got a right to be offended. So you must have done something wrong. And again, it's not like women have a corner on this at all. So let's just acknowledge that. But you know, the culture of offense is equal opportunity. But I think in marriage, broad strokes, I think it is more likely. There's going to be exceptions, but it's more often, I think, that a husband might feel the pressure to say sorry to his wife, even though he hasn't done anything wrong, than vice versa. So we're getting into conflict resolution here, which is something we're going to talk about in a few sessions. I think we're actually going to flip the order around, and we're going to talk about physical relationship next month, and then talk about communication and conflict resolution after that. We sometimes play the "I'm going to wait for the other person to say sorry first" game. And we wait for the person who we think has sinned the worst to say sorry first. And usually the person who sinned the worst is, of course, the other person, right? So I think an important thing a husband can do, if there's been a conflict and maybe his wife is in the wrong, but maybe he responded in a really snappy way or got offended unnecessarily or whatever, he should take the initiative to say, "For what I did wrong, I apologize. And I ask your forgiveness," and that, and not to wait for her to say sorry for her part. So, I'm just repeating what you're saying, Julie. But yeah, 100%, I agree with that, very, very, very much so. And let's just say here again, as we get into conflict resolution, we've talked about some of the stereotypes and how some of those stereotypes are warranted. But whoever thinks that men are not emotional doesn't know very many men, right? Men are emotional in different ways than women, but men are emotional in some pretty significant ways. And even men who pride themselves on not being emotional there, you know, there are emotions going on. So this is going to be something that when we talk about conflict resolution is the way in which men are as susceptible as women in being swept away by the passions of emotions and saying and doing really stupid stuff. And odds are, if there's been a conflict, you both have something to apologize for. Odds are, if you see a log in your spouse's eye, or if you see a speck in your spouse's eye, odds are there's a log in your own eye too. So very, very helpful point. We want to wrap this up here. And then, of course, there's always the after party, but we want to sew up this. Not that we have said everything. Far from it. Far from it. But we don't want to escape what is perhaps the most important part of all of this, is that God assigning these responsibilities to men and to women, for wives to submit to their husbands, for husbands to use their authority to cherish their wives, the most fundamental basis for all of this is not because our brains are different, is not because our bodies are different, is not because men have more strength and testosterone or anything like that. That is all a part of a bigger picture that rests on an even deeper foundation that we cannot ignore. And that deeper foundation is in Ephesians 5. Therefore, man, verse 31, therefore man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is profound. Okay, in the Greek New Testament, the word mystery does not mean hard to understand. It basically, we would do much better to translate this word as secret. It means something that was hidden, now revealed. So no one knew, reading Genesis chapter 2 for years and centuries, that verse, what verse is this in 2:24, Genesis 2:24, that was a mystery. They just thought, because of this, man leaves his husband, or man leaves his father and mother, joins fast to his wife. Paul says this is a mystery. This is actually a secret pointing to something bigger that's been revealed. What is this mystery? Verse 32, and I am saying that it refers to Christ and the church. This is the biggest, most fundamental reason for all of this. Why must wives submit to their husbands? Because the church submits to Christ in all things. And why must husbands love their wives as Christ loved the church? Because, well, we just said it. Why must husbands love their wives this way? Because Christ loved the church and laid his life down for them and loves his church in this way. And God designed marriage to be a living, breathing picture of the relationship between the church and Christ. And that's the reason why he made us different. Because when Paul says this mystery is profound, what he's saying is that all the way back in Genesis 2, when God was setting up the very first marriage, he had Christ and the church in view, right? So most of you will have heard this already. So it's not like Paul's thinking, you know, we need a good way to make marriages work. Oh, I know, it's kind of like Christ and the church. No. It's actually all the way back in Genesis, Christ and the church was in God's mind, because that's his plan for all time, is to unite all things in Christ. And so he created human marriage to be a picture of Christ and the church, and designed men and women the way that he did, so that we could reflect and image forth these created, these beautiful differences, so that marriages could be a big picture of Christ and the church. So this is where we're not going to flesh this out tonight, but this is where I love even the title of John Piper's book on marriage. It's called This Momentary Marriage, right? Pointing to the fact that Jesus says there won't be marriage in the new creation. But then the subtitle is A Parable of Permanence. Marriage is a parable. We could say a diorama, a living picture of this permanent reality. It is a shadow of the real thing, which is Christ in the church. Why is that helpful? How is that helpful to remember that? What practical effect does it have on a marriage to remember that this is designed to be a picture of something far greater? How does that actually help a marriage? Now, it doesn't need to help a marriage if it's true. It's just true, okay? But does it help a marriage, and how?
Thank you.
But I think you're onto something. There will be moments, husbands, where you being called to lay down your life for your wife, which, let me just say this, tonight we've mostly talked about husbands loving their wives through an appropriate use of authority. But we could, and perhaps should, have talked about all kinds of ways that husbands lay down their lives for their wives outside of that, right? Like picking up the rag and finishing the load of dishes when after supper when she's had a day that she didn't plan on, and all kinds of ways that husbands lay down their lives for their wives. And there will be times when the only thing that will keep a husband or a wife going in the hard work of submission and laying your life down for one another is remembering this isn't about me. This is a picture of something a whole lot bigger. This is not about me. This is not about us. This is not about how this makes me feel right now. This is not about I feel so fulfilled or not. This is about Jesus. This is about magnifying Jesus. This is about giving a picture of something bigger than ourselves for other people to see and be drawn to Jesus. So particularly for those of you who are not married, your marriage will not be able to support the weight of all of your hopes and dreams. It just can't. Your marriage can't support the weight of everything that you're going to be tempted to put on it. But joining your life with someone else to magnify Christ, that can support a lot of weight. Magnifying Jesus together, you can put a lot of weight on that. And this is one of the ways in which remembering this is not fundamentally about us. This is about us acting out a much bigger story. Gives you a foundation for your marriage that you can put some weight on, that you can weather some storms together through as you rest on that foundation. And there is so much joy to be found in this, so much more joy to be found than the tiny transactional, I do this for you if you do this for me. I'll say sorry to you if you say sorry to me. I'll love you if you respect me. I'll submit to you if you let me do the thing I want. I'll lay down my life for you if you give me what I want later on. And just that tiny transactional piece, those transactional pieces, if we entirely transform that and get rid of all of that and instead recognize we have joined our lives together that we might live out a parable of the greatest story ever told. And when our marriage is long gone, we will step into the real thing that will live forever. And we get to just rehearse for and live out in miniature. Right now, I'm building a model airplane with Judah. So it's a model airplane that a relative gave to him when he was 6 years old. And we opened the box and we said, this will wait till you're older. Okay, it's just incredibly complicated. But it's a lot of fun as Jude and I are building this little model airplane together. But what makes the model airplane cool is that it's this little pick. And I mean, today I was putting together little seat belts. They're just incredibly complicated. What makes it special is that it represents something a lot greater than itself. If you only had model airplanes you don't make a model of something that doesn't actually exist. It's the fact that it represents a real airplane with a real engine that really flew through the skies and helped win Second World War. That's what makes it really cool. And I guarantee you that if we were to actually go get to see one of these real airplanes, we would kind of look at the model and go, man, that's cool. It's just like that. But we would be fascinated with the real thing. The real thing is what makes the model special. And so it is that the reality of Christ in the church is what makes marriage what it is, what makes it worth doing, what makes it worth doing our best at, what makes it able to bear up the weight of our disappointments. And I could go on and on about that. But don't forget, never forget that your marriage is not in the end about you. That marriage, in the end, is a way that we build and enjoy a little miniature greatest story ever told. Lord, would you help us to remember that? For those who will hear these words, who are in the season of a marriage that's going really well, would you help them, Lord, to receive that joy as just a taste of the joy, Lord Jesus, that you and your church experience when we're in fellowship with you. And for those who will hear these words whose marriages are not in a season of joy, would you help them, Lord, to lay down their disappointments at your feet and submit to your design for marriage, that even through the pain and the struggle, you might empower them to do what they can, living out their part of this imperfect picture of something that is going to melt away into beautiful reality forever. For those who are not yet married, Lord, help them to see through their future marriage, to not see their future marriage as the end of the line, but something to see through to the great beyond of the reality. And Father, I pray that that you would help us with this by your Holy Spirit. May the marriages represented here, future and present, be marked with the joy that comes from living out your design. I pray this in your name. Amen. Way of summing up what I was saying there at the end is I think a marriage is not something just to look at, but something to look through. To look through a marriage to the reality that it portrays. And that is where true joy and stability and blessing and all of that is found. I think if we just look at a marriage, at our marriage, we will have all kinds of reasons to be disappointed, dissatisfied, impatient, etc. But if we look, like Ephesians 5 leads us to look through our marriage to the reality, there's so much there. Okay, that's all I've got.